This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. Today, we're talking about the needle exchange program in Scott County, Indiana, created to combat the HIV outbreak that made national headlines in 2015 and which has been touted by health officials for significantly helping to slow the spread of infectious diseases in the area. County commissioners recently voted to end the program. Today, we'll find out why and talk to a group of experts and advocates about what impact its loss might have. We're joined now by John Lisenby, Vice President of the Scott County Commissioners. We also reached out to Commission President Mike Jones and Commission Member Randy Julian to join the program, but did not hear back. John, I want to start with this vote. How did you vote in this recent decision on the needle exchange program?
Well, I voted to continue the program. The program has been in effect since 2015. I would tell you in 2015, I probably would have voted no. I come from a law enforcement background. Law enforcement sees a side of this program that's they don't always agree with. But since being elected to county commissioner 2.5 years ago, I've had the opportunity to work closely with the health department on this, and I've studied the evidence with them and looked at all the professional aspects of it. And it just comes down to, I think, the program working. The needle exchange program, SSP, whichever you prefer to call, it has reduced the amount of new HIV cases in Scott County to one last year, 2020. And I think in 2015, we started with 5 cases, and it closely shot up to 157 and was on the rise. And this program has brought the new infection rates down to almost nothing. So mm-hmm. It's working.
Well, what was that pivotal moment for you where you changed your mind about this program and realizing that it worked?
Well, I suppose you could just call it an education process. You sit and you listen to the facts. You got to keep an open mind. And the more I looked at it, and it just became obvious. It wasn't any one thing. It was a series of things. And it was an opportunity to work with the health department, also to work with and around many people who have been through the program and who have got their lives in order. While the syringe service program is made to stop the growth of HIV, it also has the aspects of putting in contact a lot of people who are injecting drugs into their system. It gets them in contact with programs who can help them. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of people in our community through our program called Thrive who have quit the drugs, quit the needle, all that stuff, and they're productive citizens in our county now.
Right. And I mean, is it fair to say that a program like this, you know, for folks that are saying, well, they're exchanging dirty needles for clean needles, but at least they're coming in and getting other extra resources on top of that to help them perhaps quit?
They get a lot of resources. We have the tendency to think of this program as just about the spread of HIV, but it's also trying to stop spread of hepatitis C, which is another serious program. And through this, the health department help people manage their health issues and tries to get them on a better path to recovery and just better life skills.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you were the one commissioner that voted to continue this program. Do you have any sense why the other two commissioners, Mike Jones and Randy Julian, voted to end the needle exchange program?
Well, you know, they have their own reasons. I think Mike, he also worked in emergency service to the fire department, and he's had to dispense Narcan several times, and he sees the side of it the average citizen doesn't see. I get that. I've been in law enforcement. It's not pleasant. Law enforcement, emergency service in general, don't like to see needles on the ground. They have to deal with it. So their concerns, I think, are legitimate. But I think in the long run, it doesn't hold up to the evidence that shows that the program is working.
Mm-hmm. And how would you go about convincing the commissioners, if you could, to reverse their vote?
Well, I don't know if that can be done. I do know this much, and I have talked quite a bit with our health officer about this. I really believe law enforcement especially needs to, our health department needs to work a lot closer with law enforcement to show the side of evidence that that the health department's seeing. Police see one side, health department see another side. I think they've got to work a lot closer together to understand each other. And once that happens, once there's a trust is gained between the two, I think we can see significant change happen here.
Mm-hmm. Well, is this program definitely going to end this January? That's it. The votes are in.
The votes are in for it to end in January. We don't even have to take another vote. We don't even have to advertise. Come January 1, the program's over, unless at least one of the other two commissioners has thoughts about it and changed their mind. It doesn't look at this point like that's likely.
Well, what's the I guess, the aftermath? Like, what's going to happen when this exchange program ends?
Well, of course, nobody can read the future, but all the evidence that shows from places that have quit before that they'll start seeing a rise in HIV and hepatitis C. And when that happens, especially in Scott County, a little county that started with 5 cases, 215, and now has over 200, the chances are they're going to start sharing needles again. And when they do, the infection rates are probably going to take off and take off quick. Of course, the options we've got at that point would be to enter back into the program, but a lot of damage will be done before that can happen.
Right, right. Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Well, John, what is the community saying about this decision?
Well, during the process of this vote, I got overwhelming support from the community. I was a little bit surprised, to tell you the truth. In 2015, the courtrooms were packed with people who was against the program, and the commissioners took the decision to listen to the health department at that point and start the program. Just the opposite happened here in this last vote we took. The courthouse was flooded with people. I mean, we had everybody down from Dr. Jerome Adams, a former attorney general, or I'm not sorry, surgeon general. We had Mrs. Box, state health commissioner. We've got letters here from Indiana University and other counties saying we need to continue the program. I was very much surprised that the support was there as strong as it was. Now, saying that, I know there's a lot of people who don't like the program, but I think everybody has to learn from this. The program itself, if you just say the word syringe or needle and drugs, it's an automatic turnoff for people. Mm-hmm. It's an education process. It's long term. And I'm afraid it's going to get even worse. But we'll see. This is one of them things that I voted to continue. And I hope my fellow commissioners are right. And I hope the HIV rates stabilize. And I hope the drug problem goes away. I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, if so, we'd be lucky. But I doubt that'll happen.
Well, when it comes to the community, you're mentioning that they've sort of shifted a little bit in their views and maybe more people are coming out in support of this program. How much of a say does the community have? I mean, when it's up to the commissioners to put the vote through?
Well, the community, it's, you know, they have a say, so they elect us. And so the community can make a big impact here. There's been I had a tremendous amount of support. People call me, say, continue the program. Now, you always have to worry if there are people out there just being silent, not telling you anything. And we know that can happen. And I have heard from several of those people. But it's like I say, it's a long-term project. 3 years ago, I was committed to vote no against it. But I've talked to our former sheriff here. He was there when the program started. He was against it in the beginning, but like he said, he learned. Our current sheriff for it, our doctors all seem to think it's a good program. Nobody, I think the one deterrent we'd like to stop would be the needles on the ground, the needle litter. Mm-hmm. Although the health department gets 92% of the needles back, there's still needles found on the ground, and that's a very bad optical. People see that, and they automatically have a dislike for the program. So if you really want to improve this program, it'd be better better return on the needle rate, even though 92% is a great rate. The goal, I think, amongst everybody who's had a problem with this thing was to get 100% return rate, a needle for a needle. Mm-hmm. And being we're using Sharps containers, it's very hard to count needle for needle. So I know our health department worked very hard to get them all back. But the truth is, we'll never get them all back. I worked with the town of Austin, which is where a lot of this breed started. And I've walked with the Thrive community, different ones, to pick up needles in Austin. Those numbers are coming down. The group, these are actual people who have been a part of the program in the past. They're out there trying to clean up the town themselves, pick up the litter, debris. And I think it's actually working. But as long as there's a few needles going to be here and there, and my friends in law enforcement say a lot of needles, but as long as that optic's there, I think it's a turnoff for most of the public.
Right. Well, what is your thoughts for what's to come, you know, with the potential for this program to be gone in January? Is there anything else that could replace it?
Well, there's it's mostly a medical thing at this point. The health department can guide people in the right direction, but they won't be able to hand out the needles anymore. So the direction we're heading, I think, is more needle sharing and which more than likely will result in a higher rate of HIV growth in this community. The results are, people having better discipline in their own lives. But we know that's not working. We wish everybody would self-discipline herself and not take drugs and not have to use needles and not have to and take better care of themselves health-wise. But that's as much as I agree with that, it's very unrealistic. So I'm worried about where we're heading with this.
And I guess we'll just have to wait and see if anything changes in the meantime. As you mentioned, maybe they could change their minds, the other commissioners, perhaps.
We'll see. They did give us this 6 month period or 6 to 7 month period to January 1st. They were talking about shutting it off in September. I think the other two commissioners' goal is to start up some other kind of program to help people with not necessarily HIV, but drug issues. And we're not sure what that program is going to be. But I think people have to separate the HIV from the drug problem, even though they are connected. But the HIV treatment program was made to stop the growth of HIV. The SSP was made to stop the growth of HIV, and it worked. We still have
a lot of work. Well, we'll definitely be in touch with you. Thank you so much, John Lisenby, Vice President of the Scott County Commissioners. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. We're talking today about a needle exchange program ending in Scott County, a program designed to slow the spread of HIV in a community that became the epicenter of Indiana's opioid epidemic in 2015. If you have any questions or comments on the topic, find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. With us now, we have two guests, Phil Stuckey, Executive Director of Thrive Recovery Community Organization, and Kelly Hans, HIV Prevention Outreach Coordinator in Scott County. Welcome to both of you. Kelly, you're one of the people who runs the Needle Exchange Program in Scott County. We talked a little bit about this in the first segment. Can you explain what happens there on a day-to-day basis?
We see people come in. Obviously, they come in for syringes. Sometimes we just get people that come in, they want to be tested or they need Narcan. But a normal visit is they return any used syringes that they have, and we replace those used syringes with clean ones and provide them a Sharps box. We see if it's been if they haven't been tested in the last 3 months. We try to get them tested. We offer them Narcan if it's needed, and we offer resources to people if they're ready to get into treatment and whatever that looks like for them. So inpatient or outpatient, or if they're interested in any kind of MAT services, which is medicated assistant treatments, therapists, we're able to provide resources for all of those.
So it sounds like there's a lot of different elements happening. It's not just a needle exchange program there.
Correct.
What were your thoughts when the county commission voted to end the program? Does that cancel everything that's going on, or is it just the needle exchange?
They say that we will still be able to operate like we normally do. We just will not be able to hand out syringes. So we'll still be able to provide the Narcan. We'll still be able to provide the other harm reduction things like clean cookers, sterile water, obviously the Narcan, anything that they would need. We just would not be able to provide the syringes.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask you a little bit more about that. But, Phil, why are needle exchange programs valuable?
So one of the biggest reasons why they're so valuable is not only you had John Lisby on earlier who talked about the suppression rate of and infectious diseases that happen with HIV and Hep C, but one of the biggest reasons is because of that first human touch that they get to handle with that population, where they get to the population that the syringe services program serves is people that don't have a trust for people. It's a population of people that haven't been treated with a human connection. And one of the first things that those girls down there at the syringe program do is they offer them unconditional love, and they treat them with that first interaction as a human being.
Well, you know, we've heard some of the criticisms. Folks have this conception that it's encouraging drug use to be providing them the tools in a way. How do you respond to that?
So one of the biggest things is, for me, the war on drugs ever since the late 70s, early 80s is not working. I think we have found that out. I think that, the more that you get to know and the research and the data that you have is that if people are going to use, what we can offer them is just a safe way to do it until they are ready to get help. Even when they're not ready to get help, just a safe way of doing it. When people say it's enabling them, to me, I actually see that as that's loving them before they actually know how to take care of themselves. So I can understand that point of view. Someone in long-term recovery as myself, I don't agree with it. I really think it's really meeting people where they're at today and seeing how we can best help them, not try to dictate to them what we think is best for them.
Right. And Kelly, how do you dispel some of these misconceptions?
I, along with Phil, I don't agree with the enabling them. I would say that if we do enable them, we enable them to be healthy while they are using, and we enable them to stay alive by providing them Narcan. We definitely do meet everybody where they're at here. And sometimes people are ready to make a change and they're scared. They don't know where to go to ask for help. We've built relationships with people here and those people sometimes don't trust anybody else. So we definitely meet them where they're at. One of the big things that I've heard is they need to take personal responsibility for themselves. I heard the other two commissioners keep saying that over and over. And the way I look at it is every time they walk through our doors, they are taking personal responsibility for themselves. They have chosen to be responsible, to stay healthy and have to find a better way of using while they are still using. And then they're engaging in those conversations with us as to possibly getting into treatment or some kind of treatment.
Well, what about in the earlier segment, John mentioned the litter of the needles around town kind of maybe give the program a bad rap. Do you think there's anything with the messaging that could be changed to alleviate some of that?
I don't know the answer to that question. So I don't even know that all of those needles are particularly coming from our program. Other than Thrive, as a recovery community organization, we sponsor cleanups monthly. So we go out and pick up trash, and we pick up any needle litter that we find there. And then as girls here at the health department, we will often take off once a week or every other week to try to pick those up off of the streets if we find them. And, of course, if anybody finds them in their yard, they can call us. Or they call 911 and then we get dispatched to go pick those up. I don't know what the solution is with the needle litter and how we can make that better.
Right. Well, Phil, I'll ask you sort of a similar question. I mean, when it comes to needle litter, like, how is that the responsibility of a program that's trying to help people get clean needles?
Yeah, I don't think it is. And one thing I do is, you know, when they talk about the needle litter, what the needle litter looks like today is what it looked like back in 2015, 2016 is significantly less. I think the sheriff actually gave out that they were dispatched to two calls in 2021 with needle pickups. I believe the health department said they had around 11 or 12 needles in 2020. So, I mean, we're talking about significantly less needles that are out on the street and that are being exposed. Because what we're seeing is we're seeing a lot of people taking that personal responsibility that was asked for, and they are taking these needles back to the syringe program. Now, granted, you may have a few people not in the program that were still littering their products and you know, their paraphernalia, but you do have a lot of people that have stepped up that use the program that take their needles back there. So when we talk, I think that more is something that has just been part of what used to be a problem that no longer is a problem, that just becomes part of the rumor mill rather than what is actually seen. Also, I would imagine, and if I seen a needle in my yard and it was only one a year, then that would be the biggest thing that was going on. So my perception may look different than what the actual data is.
Mm-hmm. And Phil, with regards to your organization, what exactly does Thrive do in this arena?
Yeah, so we actually have our hands in a lot of different things. We have about 8 or 10 programs. One of the biggest programs that we offer is through DMHA and FSSA, and it's ran through the Indiana Recovery Network. It's called the Regional Recovery Hubs. We offer 100% free peer recovery coaching. We're pretty much as brokers of resources outside of the silos of any entity. So we can actually give you the best holistic options rather than trying to point you in one direction. We really talk with the client, meet them where they're at, and try and get them the services. Because the bottom line is, and it's kind of hard to understand this, but the people that know what's best for them are the people that are receiving the services. And so we really get to know the clients, and we get to know, you know, what will work best for them and help them with to overcome the barriers to get them into whatever they need. If it's a needle exchange program, if it's MAT services, like Kelly mentioned earlier, if it's housing, transportation, we're just brokers of resources.
Mm-hmm. And what does this mean for your organization if this needle exchange program closes? What does that what happens to your clients?
Yeah, so just as of the last around 16 to 18 months of some of our data, we had over 471 people come from the syringe program in Scott County to come get services for us. Now, we oversee 21 counties, but that's just a population in one county, 471 people just from that one entity. That's 471 lives that have been changed, or they've started a journey in recovery due to the relationship they've built with the syringe program. So for me, we're missing out on a population, and we're not capturing those people and to show them that we're there for them and that we can be there for them when they decide to get help. So it scares me. It scares me a lot.
And Kelly, when you have folks that are coming to get help, what is the common, I guess, thing that most people come to see you for?
When they're coming to get help?
Mm-hmm.
They're ready to start an inpatient. We help a lot of our people get into inpatients, and they're usually 30-day programs. And that's what we see the most. We also have, I would say right below that, is to get into medicated assistant treatments. A lot of our people, the fear is the withdrawal, is going through the withdrawal of opiates. And that's where a lot of people get stuck and scared to make that change because they're afraid of going through that withdrawal. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when you get them into certain 30-day programs, they can help with that withdrawal. So they're not as bad as what they would go through trying to do it on their own at home.
Right. Well, if someone's listening right now and wants to quit and they're afraid of withdrawal, what's something you could tell them?
Oh, there's a lot of things that I could tell them. and they're afraid of wanting to quit and afraid of withdrawal. It doesn't last forever. It's so much better on the other side. And reach out and ask for help. Somebody will listen and somebody will help and somebody will love them through the process.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Phil, when we talk about these kinds of programs, a lot of questions come up about funding and how do you keep these programs running. What is it like for you?
So Thrive, you know, our donations and our fundraisers, that's one of our biggest, you know, payer sources. But right now, actually due to COVID, a lot of funds were allocated from the SLR grant, which is the state opioid response money. So DMHA, you know, got with some stakeholders and some leaders, and they said, what can we do to keep people involved? So this is some money that is not sustainability. It's just enough to keep us running for a few years. So we're looking for other sustainability things to do and to get involved with. Of course, with things that are going on now, I mean, the $26 million that was put back into the budget for, you know, Indiana's budget. And then amazingly with what President Biden, for the first time ever, has put 10% of his annual budget in there for recovery resources. So that to me just shows the stigma, the conversation, you know, just how even local leaders are trying to really get involved and help out. So funding opportunities are becoming more available. But just knowing that this is the topic of conversation with funding, it makes me feel like we're getting into a good space.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the state gives as much support as it should for recovery programs and resources?
Absolutely. I tell you what, Governor Holcomb's office and Doug Hunsinger, the drug czar under Governor Holcomb, Jay Chaudhry with DMHA, could not be any more advocates and allies for people in recovery. Of course, more funding is better, right? But the state really does. They try to figure out the best way we can help, and they sit down and they have meetings with local counties, and they ask, what are things that you need help with? So as far as what they do offer and what they are able to listen to and come up with some strategies, absolutely. I think Indiana is one of the top states that really listens to the recovery communities.
Well, Kelly, with needle exchange programs in Indiana, it's a county-by-county thing, and people who support it say it gives counties control over whether they do it and how they do it. But some are arguing that it could be a more stable, robust program if it was run by the state. What are your thoughts on that?
I would love for it to come out of the hands of politics. I would love for it to not be political. And I wish that we could have like the medical experts, the scientists, the people who have been studying harm reduction over the last 30 plus years make those decisions. I'm going to stop at that.
Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying. It's important to have folks who are actually with the health knowledge to sort of be pushing for these programs possibly and helping to run them. But, you know, I guess politics is part of everything. So Phil, what are your thoughts on the pros and cons of the state running these programs versus counties?
So I'm going to defer to how Kelly very professionally handled that. I'm going to say this, that we had former Surgeon General Dr. Jerome Adams. We had the State Health Commissioner, Christina Box. We asked professionals to come in and help us the best we can with what they study, what their understanding is, and the best way to run things. You know, Dr. Adams said that, you know, Scott County had the best syringe program, the most suppressed viral load in the state. You know, just those kind of things are saying how this thing is working. And to make it a political agenda, to me, that's the difference on client care and patient care versus political agendas. And when we murky the waters with political versus community, I think we're always going to have that issue. So I think at any time, you know, I don't I don't take my car to the farmer's market and ask the guy selling me vegetables to change my oil or to change my transmission, right? I go to the professionals for these type of things. So I definitely think that having the professionals that are experts in that field run it is a, would be way better off.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time to join us today. Phil Stuckey, Executive Director of Thrive Recovery Community Organization, and Kelly Hans, HIV Prevention Outreach Coordinator in Scott County. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about county commissioners in Scott County voting to end the needle exchange program there and about the current state of the opioid crisis in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881, or you can send us voice messages without making a call by using our smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop, free and easy to use. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. That's V-O-X-P-O-P. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam. So back now to our discussion on the opioid epidemic and needle exchange programs in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. With us now is Carrie Lawrence, Associate Director of the Rural Center for AIDS STD Prevention at Indiana University. Welcome, Carrie. We've been talking in the show so far about the needle exchange program in Scott County, Indiana, the epicenter of the state's opioid crisis in 2015, and the recent news that county commissioners voted to end the program. What was your reaction when you heard about that decision?
It still is very disappointing, because I've kind of used the work that Kelly's doing and some of the other folks in Scott County to keep people, injection drug users, safe. And so I would hate to think that all the work that the community has been doing up until now. And in fact, I think when you were talking about needles that had been discarded improperly, I was teaching a class a couple of years ago, and I brought a bunch of students down to do a big cleanup and to learn more about the needle exchange, public health students. So I think that, you know, the local health departments are a great place for some needle exchanges. Here in Bloomington, we have a separate non-for-profit that opened up called the Indiana Recovery Alliance, and they provide needle exchange services, as well as a lot of the other public health services for testing, and not just around HIV, they do viral hepatitis as well, which I don't know if anybody had mentioned that. And we've seen more hepatitis cases, but then still people come in and they can get access to Narcan or naloxone. And then a lot of the volunteers and staff go out and educate employees at different workplaces on how to administer naloxone and respond to an overdose. So, I mean, it's in a way, I feel like here in Bloomington, a college town, we really look to all of the amazing things that Scott County has done and the work that Kelly has done to be best practice. And so we're fortunate to have these, sometimes they're a gateway to various services and linking to organizations that provide recovery services as well. So, you know, it's kind of a one-stop shop that's essential for maintaining our public health as a state.
Well, I mean, as we discussed earlier, there's this misconception around this program, and you're mentioning that it's actually looked at as a best practice for other people to follow their lead. Was there any evidence that could have I don't know, changed folks' mind that this was working? Or is it that if people are set in their ways, they're just not going to hear the information?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. I mean, I think everyone comes to the table with their, when they're given a variety of topics, and they form their own opinion. I would hope it's an informed opinion, you know, that they've actually looked at what the science says behind it. But that's not, unfortunately, that's not always the case. But I think in this case, what has been always, and I really do mean it, like for a while, Scott County really has built a really nice program that really, you know, really has the ability to link back community members that people maybe had disregarded because of their substance misuse, and given a, you know, helped devise a pathway back into the community or back into a family. And so, you know, I think that like those the connections that are formed and built, I think are a key to, you know, getting someone to start the journey of recovery and sustain the recovery because of the connections that are healthy connections that are formed.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were studying HIV when the outbreak happened in 2015. What was that like for you studying this and watching everything unfold?
I think it was because of the rural center. And I think for me, the first thing that came to my mind, especially growing up in Indiana, and now I can say that Jeannie White, Ryan White's mother, is on our board for the rural center. And the whole time I was thinking of like, I can't imagine knowing what she went through with her own son, and who unfortunately lost his life to AIDS, was thinking when news is all of a sudden, you know, Scott County is making national news around this outbreak. I mean, that's, I think for me, like was that, you know, no, I wouldn't have never imagined at the time in my position, even in my faculty position, knowing that there would be an HIV outbreak in Indiana again.
Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Well, in the years since, you know, you studied that outbreak, have you seen things getting better?
In some places, yes. And so, I mean, I think in Monroe County, we do an outstanding job, and the Indiana Recovery Alliance does an amazing job with providing, you know, a mobile unit where they can go out and provide, like, try to meet people where they're at, and no one's left behind, and connecting people with other services, I think has been, I've been fortunate to witness some of the positive change that has really happened because of the work that syringe services do in communities. I mean, I think there's always the small situation, or, you know, the situation where people don't agree with syringe service programs, but I think it's sometimes just really also having to understand the benefit of a public health service and what it does to keep the community healthy. That's mm-hmm. not just always reactionary, that it's sometimes preventing something bad from happening. And at least my interaction with both syringe service programs in the southern part of the state, but I've also done work all the way up in South Bend and some other of the other counties in Indiana, as well as even other states. And so I think, you know, nobody at the time would think about like this as being part of this larger public health system, but until more recently, but I think that it's now we've gained some traction. And for once, I have to say, you know, just as a professional, and when I go to a conference or something, it's kind of nice when people are not looking even down at thinking Indiana would just let another outbreak happen, you know. And sometimes it's all so educating some of the other states. A couple years ago, myself, along with the director at the time of the Indiana Recovery Alliance, we drove over to Ohio and trained a bunch of public health nurses on syringe service program, developing one for their community. So I think it's nice to know that like we are helping grow public health as a state and can be a positive model for what to do in order to prevent a disease outbreak.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder, I mean, are you seeing sort of a shift in the way these topics are talked about? Is it more in the open, or is it still a struggle to get state and local governments to take these on as serious issues?
I've seen more of more challenges at a state level than I do at a local level. But I think the key is at the local level, the more like the syringe service program that Chris Apert and I helped out in Ohio, I think for me was the fact that we could, you know, it was a community. It was the community members that were kind of pulling things together, and it wasn't like a state or federal agency coming in and saying you have to do this. So I think that to me was something that was really key into watching things become successful. Because, you know, I think with anything that kind of pushes an individual person's, like, you know, our ideas around, you know, I remember, you know, just even my own kind of initial reaction to a syringe service program. My first like knee jerk kind of reaction was, you're going to do what? You know, I can see why there's this, a lot of times we get pushback because you don't know what you don't know. And so I think that's where I think with public health, we can do a really good job of, you know, educating and translating the evidence into something digestible where people can understand why we're doing what we're doing.
Right, right. It seems like there's a lot of fear of the unknown. And when you don't know what something is, it's easier to be afraid.
Right.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the folks that you've been able to talk to. You've talked to people with stories of recovery or attempted recovery. What are the most common barriers you hear about that makes it difficult for people to get clean?
I think it's a lot, you know, I think a good proportion of it is a little bit of, you know, looking at like their own mental health and their access to some type of support, and knowing that sometimes programs work, you know, a structured program works really well, but sometimes others need more of a, you know, an AA or NA experience where they can just drop in. But I think it's really what I've seen out of the successes that have happened is the connections that have been formed, the positive connections and relationships that have been formed as a result of someone at least feeling empathetic to another person's experience.
Mm-hmm. And what role does the community play? I mean, I know you've talked to different communities around the state that are dealing with these challenges. Are there any communities that are dealing with this better than others?
I would say the, I mean, I personally think Scott County does a phenomenal job. So definitely props to Kelly and the other staff and volunteers that put in the work. I have used the work and the structure that Scott County has done with other counties looking to start some sort of program. But it really just depends on the community and the needs that the community has, and being able to tailor, you know, kind of personalize the care that's being provided, I think is real key. But I know that there are some states that have done some amazing things just because they had the resources to do so. Others are, you know, facing a little bit more challenges. And, you know, this is one public health service where we don't necessarily have a pathway of billable services like you would in healthcare. So I think it's really just the having the resources needed in order to provide those services in order to have a staff, I think is really key.
Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, I'm going to ask you what I asked everyone else. I mean, what do you think is next for Scott County if this program is gotten rid of?
Well, I wouldn't be if we no longer have it, I wouldn't be surprised if we may not have another HIV outbreak, but viral hepatitis is pretty common in needle sharing. So I think I would be, you know, I would still, there would still be a public, it would just, it could mean a bigger public health threat is on the horizon if there's nothing to prevent it.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything nearby that folks could go to that's not in Scott County?
I think the close, and I may have to be corrected, but I'm thinking like the close of, if I can't think of another close. I would say Clark County is maybe the closest option that comes to my mind, but I could be wrong.
Well, we're definitely going to keep tabs on this story. I want to thank you so much for joining us. Carrie Lawrence is Associate Director of the Rural Center for AIDS STD Prevention at Indiana University. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow for a conversation on LGBTQ history in Indiana. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.